supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we have a very colorful question of the week for you. There is a new invasive pest spreading outward from Pennsylvania that you're probably going to find in your landscape long before you'd like to. And we'll tell you all about the spotted lanternfly after we take a whole spotty bunch of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Raymond, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Raymond. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you.
And where
I'm out here in... Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
I'm out here in Landenburg.
Now, I'm thinking Landenburg. Are you out near Lancaster County?
I'm in southern Chester County, yes,
sir. Southern Chester County. Okay, good. What can we do for Raymond in Landenburg, PA?
So I bought this house not quite a year ago, and it was a rental for about 10 years, and I have a hodgepodge of lots of things everywhere that I want to move. Specifically, I have a couple rhododendrons in the front lawn, and then I have some azaleas in the back that I just don't like rhododendrons, but I don't really want to kill them either. In the back is wooded, and I wanted to see if I could, how was the best way to dig them up and move them without killing them, and if they would actually live at the edge of the woods where it's partly sunny but not extremely sunny.
Well, actually, azaleas and rhododendrons are very close members of the same plant family, and in nature, they're both what's called understory plants. They are naturally found in the canopy of hardwood forests. I guess presumably because the forests are hardwood, these plants get a lot of sun in the winter and the spring and the fall. And in the summer, they get the relief from the heat. I believe it's in the Carolinas, maybe continuing into Missouri, in the Blue Ridge Mountains. There are entire forests of rhododendrons that you don't see most of the time because the hardwood canopy is above them. But in the spring, they will bloom. There are acres of them that are continuous down on the ground under these big trees. And it's such an amazing show and a tourist attraction that in some areas they've actually built suspension bridges and kind of boardwalks so you can walk above them and not disturb their tender and shallow roots. So I think we can help with everything. What I want you to do is leave them in place for now. Allow them to bloom one more time in their current position. Then when the bloom is finished, that's the safest time to cut these plants back. Now, it sounds like you like the shape of the azaleas, so you don't have to cut them back any further than you want. But if the rhododendrons have indeed gotten leggy, you can do a really nice shaping job, selectively pruning, and you can remove up to a third of the plant. Try not to leave any bare areas in the middle because they might stay there, but you can certainly shape the top and the sides. And after they're done blooming, that's the best time to prune them without doing any damage. Then, and the pruned plants will be one-third easier to move because they won't be as big. Dig the holes that they're going to go into before you dig up the plants. Dig the planting holes first, and then get a whole bunch of guys with sharp shovels, and what you want to do is dig down around the outside of the plants about at least a foot, 2 foot away from the trunk of the plant, and you want to get those shovels down there. And if you can envision this, come up with like a floating island of soil with most of the roots still intact inside that like lump of soil, and then put that plant on a tarp, and you guys carry the plant on the tarp back to the new planting area, plant it in the ground at the same height it was before, refill the hole with the same soil you removed, but then be ready to put down a mulch of an inch of peat moss covered by an inch of compost. These are acid-loving plants, so you want to make sure their soil is nicely acidic. And then for each one, you want to immediately have a hose dripping at the base of the plant, just like a annoying faucet drip, for at least several hours, at least 8 hours. If you're going to be moving a lot of plants and you need to be moving the hose around, do an hour here, an hour to the next plant, an hour to the next one, but do that literally for a couple of days. And then make sure that the plants are well watered throughout their entire first summer back there. Even if they're getting a good amount of shade, these are shallow rooted plants. The roots are easily damaged, which is why you want to bring up that big island of soil. And they are the thirstiest plants in our landscape. So especially if summer becomes traditionally dry again, you want to have a heavy hand with the water, at least during their first season. If you do all this correctly, they may actually bloom better for you in the years after that.
Excellent.
All right, Ray?
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, good luck, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Susan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky, Susan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Warming up a little up here, so that's good.
Where is Susan doing good and it's warming up?
It's in Topsfield, Massachusetts.
Okay, what can we do for Susan in Massachusetts?
Well, a while ago, my husband and I listened to one of your podcasts where you talked about gardening over a stump on roots. We had a tree cut down a couple of years ago, and there's a large root structure under the ground. And it gets quite a bit of sun in probably June and July, so we wanted to plant a raised garden over it. So I wanted to know if you could review that again, because we didn't do it at the time, but I've kind of forgotten how to do it.
So how much of the stump is above ground?
There's about, 5-6 inches.
Because the ideal situation here is if you can have what's called grinding the stump. That takes it down to the soil line, maybe a couple of inches below. Are either you guys or any of your friends handy and reckless with chainsaws and power equipment and stuff like that?
Yeah, my husband tries to have a little fun with it sometimes.
Good, good. What I would suggest now, while we're still in the winter, is getting out there with the chainsaw and scoring that stump. Just keep cutting, kind of making hashtags in the stump over and over again. If he gets lucky and the stump is already starting to rot, pieces will probably fall off. It would be difficult to get down low and cut the stump down lower. But if he just keeps making cross cuts in the top of the stump, like I said, some of those pieces are going to fall out, but it's also going to accelerate the rotting.
Okay.
So when you get to the spring, then, do what you can. Bang away at it with a shovel and see how much wood you can get out of there. It'd be great if you could remove most of the wood. But then really all you do is you find material that you would like to use to frame your raised bed. Now, this can be regular old lumber, that you'll just replace after a couple of years. It can be Trex or another of these composite landscape timbers that are half reclaimed wood shavings and half recovered recycled plastic. I especially like the idea of using pavers to make the frame for your raised bed, because then you can really make this thing any size, any height, any length that you want. You also don't need to be nailing anything or cutting anything. And, even after you get tired of using the raised bed, you can use the pavers to build something else. Mm-hmm. But make sure whatever you build is at least a foot high and no wider than 4 feet. Because especially if it's going to be a vegetable garden or something like that, you want to be able to reach the center of the bed without ever stepping on the soil. And the advantage in your northern location is that raised bed, the soil is going to warm up a lot faster than in a flat earth garden. So you're going to get an earlier start even without doing any extra work. And if you use pavers or stone, that stone-like material will absorb heat from the sun during the day and radiate it back into the soil at night. And that gives you a little bonus time early and late in the season as well.
Okay.
Then you fill the bed with my ideal mixture is 50-50, real good, high-quality topsoil. And that means topsoil that is screened, that has fine particles, and that's black when it's dry. The other 50% should be compost, yard waste compost. And then once you do that, you plant directly in that. And one of the most important things is you remember never to step in that bed. That's why it's only 4 feet wide. You're going to reach in to the center from either side. You're never going to step in that soil. Soil will never get compacted, so you'll never have to till. The fact that the bed is raised will prevent grassy weeds from encroaching on it. So you really start out with a clean slate that should be relatively weed-free and really productive for years and years to come. And every spring, you just add an inch or two of fresh compost to the surface. You never till it in. You never dig it in. You never disturb that soil again unless something happens that really requires you to, but it shouldn't.
Okay. I will do.
All right. Good luck and stay warm.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone once again in areas that dip below freezing that rock salt, often disguised by the initials NaCl, is the worst choice for plants, pets, and surfaces when ice is an issue. Instead, use play sand. It's actually good to sweep back onto your lawn. Or use alternative de-icers like calcium chloride, magnesium chloride, and potassium chloride. But don't go checking your labels just yet, because we'll be right back with a colorful pest and more of your colorful calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, there is a new pest in town. So new, it's only been around for 3 or 4 years, but it's already threatening crops like grapevines, peaches, and apples. It is the spotted lanternfly. It's colorful and dangerous, and we'll tell you all about it after lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello there.
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm doing fine. We communicated, I don't know, a few days ago by email with regard to, I run a small grist mill, and I sell mostly grits, and I grind up yellow, white, red corn. And the byproduct, I get quite a lot of corn flour, and I had an extension agent stop by the mill to buy some grits, I don't know, 2 or 3 days ago, and I explained that I was having a hard time finding an outlet for my corn flour, And he said, oh, I read something about University of Iowa. They've done some research on using corn gluten meal as a weed inhibitor. So I did a little research, and your name popped up.
Yes, I've been writing about this since I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine back in the 90s. Now, I'm going to ask you your location. Don't be too specific, because half the state of Iowa is after you now, because it's not the university you mentioned. It's Iowa State.
I see. Okay, so I won't be specific. So it's a small historic grist mill in the Shenandoah Valley.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yes, when I got your email, I was so fascinated by this topic, I asked you to call into the show, because I really wanted to learn more even about what you're doing. Now, in a nutshell, corn gluten meal is a byproduct of corn starch manufacture. So it's very different than what you're doing. You're grinding up the kernels of corn. I believe that most of the manufacture of corn gluten meal comes from the stalks. They make corn starch, and as you have a byproduct in what you're doing, and I want to talk about grits because I want to learn more about grits. As you have a byproduct, they had an enormous byproduct. You know, all the corn starch in the world comes from mills in Iowa, and they turned to Iowa State to do something with, literally, they had these mountains of orange material all over town. And when they would get high winds, which they often get, just like Oklahoma, everything in town, all the cars, all the building sidewalks would turn orange. And it was a guy who became a real good friend, Dr. Nick Christians, who tested the material because he knew it was high in nitrogen. So it would make a good nitrogen fertilizer for sweet corn and for lawns. But when he tried it along with seed starting as like a starter fertilizer, nothing came up. And that's when he found out that the right concentration of this material called corn gluten meal, which itself is a misnomer, there's no gluten in corn, but that's what they wound up calling it, the right concentration of very high proteins inhibited the germination of seed, and it is a perfect inhibitor of springtime seed. So where people would turn to chemical pre-emergence, now there has been, since the 90s, an organic pre-emergent that would feed the growing grass but prevent the crabgrass seeds from germinating. Now, you sent me an analysis, a little bit of your flour, and it was 8% protein, which is nice. You know, which is nice. I mean, one thing I'll base it on is my cat food, because my cats, you know, need high protein in their diet. And the best I can get in a wet food, at least, is like 11%. So 8% is significant. It's not low protein, but it ain't 60%. So it's not going to inhibit the germination of any seeds. But now, after we emailed back and forth, I lost like 3 hours in research trying to figure out, because I'm a row home kid from Philadelphia. We don't know from grits, you know.
Oh, well, there's people that shop from Philadelphia that use our grits.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there are. But we grew up with home fries and hash browns, baby. You know, the potatoes went along with the bacon and eggs. So grits are ground corn kernels, maybe even of a special type of field corn, but you don't grind them very much. Is that correct? Yes, is that close?
Exactly. Everything that we do is stone ground. And when you stone grind up the kernel, you wind up with a variety of sizes, no matter, you know, and that's what this bespoke milling process really is all about, is how, you know, how far apart your stones are. And so you're always trying to optimize the amount of grits you get, because I have two screens. I have a coarse screen, and the coarsest material that comes off of the kernel is generally the husk. And so I capture the husk, and I actually give that away to my local friends and farmers as chicken food. Even the chickens have a tough time sometimes with the husk of the corn. And then the finest sieve, even if I have the stones quite far apart, you know, to grit size, I'll still get some corn flour from the endosperm and from the germ of the kernel. I'll still get some very fine material. And my fine screen, my fine sieve, captures all of that. That's about 200 microns and less. And then the middle part is grit. And the milling part, you know, I'm trying to optimize that. And lots of folks down here prefer coarse grits. And so, you know, as I pull the stones apart, all of the material gets coarser and coarser. So I get less of the 200 micron flour. I get more and more of the grits, but I also get more and more of the bigger pieces. And so that's what milling is kind of trying to optimize that center part and get, well, most people, like I said, around here like coarser grits. So I play around with the size. So I optimize that central part. And that's the milling process. I do it with yellow corn. You know, I have all different kinds. I grind different kinds, heritage corns, non-GMO, GMO. I grind it all.
Now, I want to hear about grits. Do you eat grits?
Yeah, I do. I had some yesterday or the other day. Yeah. So around here, most people eat white. I would say that I am on the dividing line because I sell equal amounts, pretty much, of yellow and white. If people come from the south, they're white. More people from the north eat yellow.
Huh. But these are all field corns, right? Not sweet corns.
Yes, correct.
And the difference being sweet corn has to be picked inside of a tiny little window when the sugar content is at its peak, and you eat it fresh, whereby field corn is left out to dry in the field until the plants are completely brown and dead, and then you know that the moisture content of the kernels will be nice and low, which optimizes techniques like yours to mill it, to crush it, and everything like that.
Correct. That's all well described.
Now, okay, so I got a bag of your grits. Does it say anything on it? Is it John's Grits? Is it Wade's Mill Grits? What's it saying?
It's Wade's Mill Grits, and we do lots of other things, but I guess that's our biggest seller would be our yellow, white, our Bloody Butcher, and our Wapsie Valley Grits.
When I was at Organic Gardening Magazine, a reader sent me, and you're a Bloody Butcher, and I planted it, and it was my favorite field corn. The stalks were like 12 feet high. The kernels were blood red, and when you ground those things up, I mean, they stayed red. You got the most amazing red cornmeal and red corn chips, and it was wonderfully sweet. That's a tremendous heirloom corn.
Yeah, no, we just started grinding that 4 or 5 months ago. There's a few farmers that are, and that's I'm new to the milling process, and so that's been the most difficult part of this new career of mine is learning who's farming various, you know, new varieties of corn and then trying to market them and get them into some of the shops and local places here in the Shenandoah Valley.
Right. New to you, but Bloody Butcher goes back to Jefferson. Yes. And Washington.
Indeed. Indeed. So, and actually, the farmer that I get the Bloody Butcher corn from, he sells most of his corn for distilling.
Really?
To some of these high-end distillers that are popping up in Brooklyn and Washington.
To make corn liquor.
To make bourbon. And, you know, most rye whiskey actually is like 45% corn and 55% rye. And bourbon has to be over 51% corn.
Huh.
So they use his Bloody Butcher corn for distilling.
Oh, that must be an amazing colored liqueur that comes out of there. Now, okay, so I got a bag of your grits and I'm going to have them with my breakfast. What do I do?
It's quite simple. 4 cups of water and 1 cup of grits. And the interesting thing is I have quite a few people ask me about polenta. And polenta is actually, it's actually fine grits, but I would never say that to a European.
Uh-huh.
They'd get upset with me. But I do sell quite a lot of polenta, but that's, I have to tighten my stones up a bit, and I get a lot more corn flour when I do that, and I get less of the rougher material. But yeah, it's depending on the coarseness of the grits, and so my grits are quite coarse, so you probably have to boil them for 35 or 40 minutes, and even coarser than that. Some people like coarser than that, and they have to cook them for an hour. But then there's a matter of adding cream and butter, and many grits, especially here in the South, are served, especially white, are served with shrimp. Shrimp and grits is a big and I sell to quite a lot of restaurants that serve that.
So that's not a breakfast food.
That's a dinner food, but yep, there's diners here that use our white grits for breakfast, and it turns out to be like a cream of wheat. If you remember cream of wheat,
I remember cream of wheat fondly. That was my hot cereal growing up.
Exactly. So it looks quite a lot like that, maybe a little bit grittier, but of course with a corn flavor as opposed to a.
I can see the pat of butter melting in the middle of my bowl right now.
Exactly.
Okay, so John, how old is this mill?
It's 1746 is the earliest documentation of a mill being here, and so 270 years old and counting.
Is it powered by mules, horses, water? Has it become modernized?
It's a water-powered grist mill, and most of the machinery dates back to the 1880s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have ground on the water-powered stones, the old stones that came from France in the 1880s. I've ground on those stones, but it's so inefficient, I can't do it profitably, or I'd have to raise the price from $5 a pound to $30 a pound in order to make a living. So I have two sets of electric stones that I grind on here at the mill. I actually do use water power for lifting. So there's through a series of pulleys and belts, there's a lifting apparatus that helps me lift the 100-pound bags of grain up to the top floor. And I am slowly getting all of the older equipment operational. So now I have the old sifters from the 1880s, the stones operate. So most of the old equipment operates. I just can't really run it as a business.
Have you ever considered a couple of times a year having like a festival and running it the old style way as like an event and maybe having a couple of other vendors on your land, but charging admission for people to come in and see how this was done long before electricity?
We actually do that the third Saturday of every October. This coming year, 2018, will be the 23rd annual Apple Butter Festival. So we combine the running of all the mill equipment with making homemade apple butter and lots of other country craft going on here at the mill. So we do that in October, and we are lining up more and more events. But I run the water wheel, and I run a lot of the equipment on weekends, most weekends, Saturdays and Sundays. And folks can see that on our website. We have hours that we're operating, and I do show people. I run tours, and there's no cost, free of charge. You can come and see how an old mill worked back in the 1750s.
And that is Wade's Mill, W-A-D-E, in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia.
That's correct.
Now, I know that you originally contacted me hoping I would have a use for corn flour for you. But as you probably know, if you've researched this, these terms are very loose. There's no real definition of what corn flour is. I think you probably have the best one when you say it's a certain micron size.
You're absolutely right. I have displays of what grits look like and what my coarse material looks like and corn flour and cornmeal. Lots of people don't understand that cornmeal is just grits and corn flour combined. You know, if I just grind up the corn and in the process, I always sift off the coarse material, which is the husk, the piece of the, you know, the
right,
piece of
that's,
popcorn.
Right, that's chicken
piece of popcorn
food.
That always gets stuck in your teeth.
Right, that's chicken feed.
That always comes off. But if I combine the grits and the corn flour, then that's cornmeal. And whenever I show people this and, you know, people can touch it and feel it, they always go, oh, that's what cornmeal is. And, yeah, it's unbelievable, you know, how many people don't quite understand, but it is all to do with size, the size of the sieves that you're using.
Your cornmeal product, isn't that what they make cornbread and everything?
Yeah,
exactly.
And we make all those mixes as well, but you can buy plain old cornmeal here and go home and make your own.
And when you talked about the heritage corns, you even mentioned your specialty is a yellow corn that I wasn't familiar with?
Yeah, the Wapsie Valley.
And that's a locally grown corn that's probably been there for hundreds of years, right?
It's actually grown in Northern Virginia, so that's where I get that from.
Hmm. And the only advice I can give you is stick with the heritage corns, with the non-GMO corns, with the open pollinated classic varieties with the great names, and do what the organic industry did. You know, keep adding value to your products with the backstory, with the names.
Yeah. And that's our plan. We are we're slowly doing that. You know, the business that we bought, they didn't have any non-GMO or open pollinated varieties. And so we've just slowly started to do that and include that into our offerings. Restaurants are slowly picking that up. So,
John, sure. I have enjoyed speaking with you tremendously. What's the website? I know it's Wade's Mill in the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Yeah, www.wadesmill.com.
Okay. I hope people come. I hope they see this amazing look into the past. We talk about growing things in a way that hasn't changed for hundreds of years, and we forget that that food was also processed in an ancient but efficient and very organic and very natural way. And this has been a great opportunity. I think our listeners are going to love this.
Great.
All right, man. Okay. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce a couple of my upcoming appearances. I will return to the Brandywine 100 Library on Wednesday evening, March 7th. I will speak at the Bayshore Center in Port Norris, New Jersey on Thursday evening, April 26th, and at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Exton, PA on Saturday, May 12th. But don't go detailing your daytimer just yet, because we'll be right back with a colorful past and more of your colorful calls. I'm Colorful Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to the question of the week about a new invasive pest that looks like a clown gone wild, the spotted lanternfly. It's crazy looking, and it could be crazy trouble for people who have grapevines and peach trees. So you won't want to miss how to find it, how to identify it, how to look for the egg cases, and what to do about it. And we'll tell you all those things after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. It's great to be on. I want to tell you, we really enjoy listening to all your podcasts. We don't get you on the radio here, but we do pick you up and listen to you every time we're on the road.
Oh, that's great. Where is here, Steve?
Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. You go to Michigan, go to the top. When you hit Canada, you come back 5 feet. That's where we're at.
I've been to Sault Ste. Marie. Yeah, that's a beautiful place in the summer. All right. What can we do for Steve up in Sault Ste. Marie?
Well, we've just retired, and we've had a garden since back in 1978. We used to subscribe to that organic gardening magazine.
Uh-huh. I remember that.
Yeah. And now we want to, you know, do more gardening, make the garden bigger, and just have fun with and do stuff. We went through the USDA program, applied for a hoop house underneath NRCS, and we're supposed to get one this spring.
Excellent.
We're looking forward to all kinds of fun with it. Our question is, what should we do so we can do it right the first time as we go through? That's any suggestions or advice you might have would be great.
Hoop houses are semi-permanent structures that are supported by very large, very heavy metal hoops, and they're covered by one or more layers of plastic that can be rolled up from the bottom or pulled down to the bottom, depending on the weather. They typically have a vent at the top of each end, and they typically have a very well-insulated door, at least at one end. And a true hoop house is not only big enough for humans to stand up in, but it's big enough to accommodate medium-scale machinery. They are more useful than a greenhouse for growing things. There's much less wasted room. And I will tell you that I've had the privilege of being on the crew of at least two hoop houses as they were being erected. I can tell you what I learned from both those experiences is you need twice as many people as anybody tells you you need. You want them to be strong. That plastic is really heavy when it's all on one side. You want to have as close to the exact right ambient temperature as possible. Now, my friend Sebastian, who has helped me build gardens for the Salvation Army and at other places, I think he said something about 55 degrees being the optimum temperature. But if you pull the plastic into place when it's too cold out, it won't set right. If you pull the plastic into place when it's too hot out, it'll start to stretch and warp. So the erection day, for lack of a better word, when that plastic is pulled into place, can't be a day on the calendar. It's got to be a day when the conditions are correct. So that's going to be a big job, is manipulating this one day of borrowed labor, because it's almost like building a pole barn. You need like 20 people. I can tell you that there are devices, you know, the lowering and raising of the plastic on the sides. As you get into the summer, you want the plastic skirt to come up from the ground so that it doesn't overheat inside the greenhouse. Have you already chosen whether you're buying manual things that you have to turn to raise and lower the bottom, or have you decided to go for the electric ones that do the job for you?
We'd like to do something with the electric just so that, I mean, you can be doing great stuff out there from what I've heard, and then one day you don't get out there on time and it gets cooked.
Exactly right. And you're talking about two different things. You're talking about having those turning things be electrified so it can be done very quickly with very little manual labor. And you're also talking about automatic temperature vents and everything, which is insanely important. So you certainly want ceiling vents that open and close on their own based on the internal temperature. The best thing you can do right now is visit other hoop houses, get to know the people who run them, who put them up, ask them what they do wrong, maybe recruit them, and in return, you know, you'll go help at the next one. But you do it right, and even up in the frozen north where you are, man, you can be growing 12 months of the year with a good plastic covering on that. And then what you're going to need is you're going to need row covers on your lettuces and your herbs and stuff inside as well. But you get that double covering, and especially on sunny days, you'll do very well. Now, the disadvantage, as you know, in the summer is you have to irrigate because the inside of the house is kind of protected from rain as well as snow. So you have to run irrigation lines in there. And as you know, you're a smart guy. You know you need to drain those in the winter and everything. But the benefits are incredible. And especially in your climate, the plastic should never come off completely. You'll just run the sides up and down. And if you've got motors to do that, you'll be thankful the second time you don't have to do that manually for like 12 different maneuvering systems.
Excellent.
All right, man?
Well, I appreciate it very much. Thank you, sir.
All right, Steve. Good luck, sir.
Thanks.
1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for taking my call.
Hey, thank you for making it, man. Where are you?
I'm in Kane, Pennsylvania.
C or a K?
K. K-A-N-E. We're up near the New York border, directly south of Buffalo.
All right. What can we do for John and Kane?
When I walk out in the woods with my dog, there's an abundance of blackberries, and there's wild raspberries, and what I believe are black raspberries. And I figure I'd save some of the seeds so I can plant them in a little plot of land that has nothing but thistle growing in it right now. And I saved the seeds over the winter, and I just put them in a little, you know, almost like a vase, a tiny one, and they dried out. And in the early spring, I bought one of those compartmental containers with the potting soil.
Right.
And it had 24, and I stuck a seed in each one, put it down an inch or so, and put water. And I kept it on in a real sunny area, and it got, you know, didn't get cold. It got plenty of sun all day long, and nothing. It didn't grow anything.
Well, most of these plants grow by what's called vegetative production. So the easiest way to establish these plants would be this coming spring. If you want to walk back there, take a bucket with you, a 5-gallon bucket with like a couple inches of water in the bottom, and look for new shoots coming up, really baby plants, nice and green ones. And then either have a little spade with you or maybe a poacher's spade, or if you can have another source of water, pour it around the plant, and then very slowly pull that out of the ground and try to get it out with some of the roots attached. If you had X-ray vision and you could look at a raspberry patch or a blackberry patch, you would see this network of old roots and new canes all kind of crisscrossing and coming off of each other. I've seen old buried canes that had 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 new canes all going off of it laterally. So they are all attached to one part of the plant, but they also have a lot of side roots. So it's very easy to actually get them to come up with some roots attached. You're also going to find some plants that grew naturally from seed, but we would do that a little bit differently. The best way to cultivate these plants, again, is to go out in the spring and very gently dig up or pull up some of the newest shoots coming out of the ground. Then you would take them in the area where you want them to grow and plant them fresh there. The big thing there is don't let them dry out. That's the only thing you'd need to do. I mean, it would be ideal to do this in a light rain that was going to last for like 3 days.
Soaking.
Yeah, then you'd get like 100% success rate. Otherwise, just make sure that that area doesn't dry out until you see like the new growth resume. Now,
okay,
these berries do reproduce by seed, but generally not with human intervention. What happens is two things. First, a berry will go unpicked. No bird will get to it. No human will get to it. And it'll get overripe and it'll fall to the ground. And then what'll happen is because it's overripe, it's kind of fermenting. And that is getting rid of any gelatinous coating on the seed. And then if all the conditions are correct, it'll naturally put down its own roots. What I would do is have a secondary picking thing. After all the good berries are gone, when they're really overripe and they're too mushy to eat anymore, collect a whole bunch of those berries of the same species and then make a little trench somewhere and just pour those berries into the trench and cover it lightly with soil. and maybe you get lucky the following year.
Oh, that's great.
So these things love to root. You shouldn't have any problem once you start collecting new canes in the spring.
Well, that's fantastic. That sounds pretty easy, too.
Yep.
Oh, I appreciate that.
All right. Good luck, sir. Stay warm this winter.
Thanks, Mike. You too. Great show.
Thank you, sir.
Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. A very important one. If you see spots, you got to call for help. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, whenever you feel like it, would you please get us started with this week's intriguing question?
Well, this week's question may be the shortest we've ever used. Ed in Conshohocken, PA, sent you a pair of photos and the brief note, do you know whether these are egg masses of the spotted lanternfly? Well, are they?
You know, I think they are. But I urged Ed to send the photos to his local extension office for confirmation and to alert them if this newly arrived invasive pest from Asia has not previously been found in his neighborhood.
They're only in a very small part of the country so far, right?
Well, a year ago, I would have said that this pest was confined to one small corner of Pennsylvania, where Berks, Bucks, Montgomery, and Lehigh counties meet up. But now it's also been confirmed in Chester County and in Delaware, the state, not the county. So officials pretty much agree that this is going to move from being a local story to one of national significance over the next couple of years. And they've made an unusually strong call for what we call citizen scientists to assist in the effort to slow the spread of this insect.
Okay, first give us the basics. What does it look like? Have you seen one?
Yeah, and it's almost impossibly distinctive. The adult forms are said to be about an inch long, but I thought the one I saw looked a little bit bigger than that. Anyway, they got two sets of wings. The ones near the head are gray with black spots. The wings towards the rear end are red with black spots. The head and legs are black, and the abdomen is yellow with black stripes.
That's crazy looking.
He got that right. This pest is not going to be confused with many other insects, although the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture thinks that they look a little bit like the tiger moth, whose wings are shaped very differently, and the equally crazily colored giant leopard moth, whose wings have none of those distinctive reds of the lanternfly.
So is this new pest in town a true fly or a moth?
Neither. It sure looks like a moth, but it's a plant hopper. It has wings that work, but it's more likely to be jumping around. And be aware that most of the ID pictures you're going to find online have the wings spread out to show you the wild colors. But in reality, those wings are often folded back when it's hopping around and feeding. That's when you can really tell that it's a plant hopper and not any kind of flyer.
Well, how is it spreading? Hopping from town to town?
Oh, yeah, just like in an old Disney cartoon. It's carrying a little bag full of its clothes up on a stick, and it's hopping around singing the lanternfly song. All right. Actually, the way it spreads is pretty nefarious. After the adults finish feeding in the fall, the females lay 50 to 100 eggs apiece on a solid object. Then they cover the eggs with a substance that makes the whole nursery look like a patch of mud. These egg masses have been found on firewood, lawn furniture, cars, and trucks.
So you load up for a camping trip in another state the following spring.
And you could have hitchhikers on the outside of your vehicle and in any stuff you're carrying that was left open to the outdoors, like that firewood.
Ah, right. We had a young woman on the show several years ago promoting a Don't Move firewood initiative, and now I can see her point much more clearly. Nobody's going to scour over every piece of wood looking for patches of mud.
So don't transport firewood, kids. In addition, state extension agents are urging people, including children, to learn to identify these egg masses on surfaces. I actually got some of my information from a coloring book published by the PA Department of Agriculture.
A coloring book?
Hey, look, come on. I stayed inside the lines. Anyway, if you see what you think is an egg mass, take pictures of it before you destroy it and send those pictures to the researchers who are keeping track of this pest. We'll provide all the links you need in the online version of this question of the week.
And if you see adults?
It's a sight you won't soon forget. I was down the shore this summer and got calls from two friends who had stumbled upon infested trees. They both described hundreds, maybe thousands of the things covering each tree. You couldn't see the trees. As expected, they were on the so-called Tree of Heaven, an invasive plant, also from Asia, that's their primary host. But they will attack other trees and grapes, apples, and peaches.
So what did you tell your friends to do?
I told them to spray horticultural oil to keep the hoppers from hopping away, cut the trees down, and burn them. For small infestations, sprays of horticultural oil alone should do the job. Now, these pests do have natural enemies back in Asia that are being actively researched. But for now, the best advice is to cut down most of the trees of heaven on your property, but leave a few standing to make what's called a trap crop. Check these trees regularly beginning in July and destroy any infestations you find. And be sure to check those same trees for egg masses over the winter. Well, that sure was some interesting information about the new pest in town, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with lots of those informative links about the spotted lanternfly, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to spot my lantern. If I don't get out of this studio, we must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you are certain that we do not need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all those questions you were going to ask us, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Terry Murray is our brand new vice president of production. Our engineer is Adam Stanishevsky. Stanishevsky, what a wine. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page.
And like us, please.
Webmasters Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website colorful. Alexis Landis occasionally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our associate producer of Production Association is Brett Rader. Our spotty editor is Al Banks. I'm your host, Green Lantern Corps member 5266 Mike McGrath. And I'll be protecting this space sector against aliens, invasive insects, and bad special effects until I can see you again next week. What is muriate of potash, and is it safe to use? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the many ways you can add the K in NPK to your landscape. Plus your fabulous phone calls. That's the next You Bet Your Garden.